Hey, it's Mike Costa, your host of My Morning Cup. I'm excited to tell you about Entrepreneurs Week coming up April 29th through May 3rd, and our little podcast, My Morning Cup, will be a big part of that. On May 1st, we'll be doing a live episode at 9 a.m. We'll be at Finley Stadium in the Ultra Club. So if you want to come out and see a live podcast being produced with our guest, Barry Large of Access America, of Lamppost Group, of Brickyard, it'll be a great conversation. I hope you can join us. To learn more, go to chabusiness.org or chabusiness.org. Welcome to My Morning Cup, a podcast produced by Costa Media Advisors and brought to you by the generous support of the Tennessee Valley Authority. To learn more about TVA's impact on our community, follow TVA on Instagram at TVA and on Twitter X at TVA News. My Morning Cup, where we have interesting conversations with genuine people. I'm Mike Costa, your host. My guest this week is Brenda Bridges. Brenda is a certified divorce financial advisor, coach, and mediator. She's the author of Oh Shit, I'm Getting Divorced. Brenda, welcome to My Morning Cup. Before we get to the twists and turns that led you to help others through the trauma of divorce, let me ask, what's in your morning cup?
It depends on mood and day, essentially. I'm not habitual that way. I'm trying to be more mindful of it. And when I am mindful, then I'll wait until about 10, 11 a.m., have my cup of coffee, put some MCT oil in it, put it in the little ninja thing, froth it all up. Really good. On other days, I'll just have, you know, a cup of coffee from my Keurig when I get into the office. I may or may not put cream in it.
What is MCT oil?
MCT oil is, it's a coconut oil derivative. So it can prolong a fasting state. And fasting has been shown to be really good for brain health. And I have a mom who has Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
So it's one of the ways to promote brain health.
Over the last few years, it's been kind of the rage with where you don't eat for 12 hours.
Intermittent fasting.
Intermittent fasting. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. And a lot of people do it for weight loss. In this case, it really is supposed to be good for your brain.
Well, and I think the interesting thing about that is there's so many religions that fasting is a part of that.
Yeah, we're in Ramadan now, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's got to be something to it that if you look back at something as ancient as what our religions are, and fasting's an integral part of Ramadan, fasting's a part of the Christian faith in terms, particularly we're in Lent. I just find that interesting. But we're not here to talk about fasting.
I know, that's
why
I was like, I could go down the rabbit hole on this.
But. I know. So we talked a little bit before we started the podcast, and I do want to get to the title of your book and what you're doing now. But I do want to start where you started. You grew up in Ohio, huh?
I grew up in Ohio.
Yeah.
I grew up a little Buckeye.
A little Buckeye. Are you still a Buckeye fan?
I was never a Buckeye fan. I really wasn't. It was not my jam. Like going through high school, I was a cheerleader and I was big into the high school. The whole high school life, the sports, we had homecomings, we had fairs. It was pretty great.
Yeah.
You know, all the normal teenage angst and all that stuff. But
we're in Ohio.
Canton. Mm-hmm. By the time I was a teenager, born in Cuyahoga Falls, or, you know, the beginning of my life until I was 12. And then we moved to Canton. And it was kind of rural and just, you know, a bunch of kids being kids. It was really neat. In fact, you know, fast forward when I had kids, I would look back and go, gee, I had it so much easier than they did as far as, I guess, the boundaries we had and how kind of carefree things could be.
The streetlight was when you determined you had to go in.
Absolutely. And every kid knew it. And the big kids took care of the little kids. And when the lights went on, you vanished.
Yeah. Unfortunately for the kids today, it was a different time for us. We did not have. There's so many more connections today, but those lack of connections then I think gave you more of a freedom of being a kid and get on your bike and ride all day.
Yeah. And a kid community and hierarchy and, you know, stuff like there was when we were littler, our neighbors had a loft in their garage, you know, and it was like nothing fancy, but they decorated it with posters and stuff like that. And you could kind of know your hierarchy by how far they would let you up the ladder. And your aspiration was to be able to get in the loft someday. You know, actually the big kids were going to let you in there. It was just different. And it's really simple.
What age as a kid did you get to the top of the ladder?
I never got to the top of the ladder.
No?
I think the older kids outgrew it and they went on to probably dating and other things. So, yeah. But it was good to have aspirations, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you grew up in Canton, Ohio, which is Pro Football Hall of Fame, mm-hmm. which I'm sure the town is dominated by that.
Which I never went to until I left.
Did you not?
No. Well, I would go to the Hall of Fame weekend because mm-hmm. they would have the cheerleaders go to the events and, you know, dress up in our little cheerleading outfits and shake pom-poms. So I would go to those events, but the actual Hall of Fame I only went to after I moved away, and it was because people would say, oh, Pro Football Hall of Fame. And after a few years, it's like, I really should go to that thing. Yeah. And it's wonderful. It was, you know, even for not a football aficionado, it was really interesting.
Well, and it is interesting that people who live in a town where there's a well-known tourist attraction are usually the last ones to get there. I bet you yeah. could go talk to 10 Chattanoogans on the street and they'll say, no, I haven't been to Rock City.
Right. Yeah, because it's always going to be there.
Yeah. So what were your aspirations when you were a kid? Because divorce coach is an unusual title.
Oh, fell way into that one. Yes. Yeah. That was so a zigzaggy path.
When you were 12, 13, you didn't say, hey, I know what I want to do. I want to be a divorce coach.
No. Even when I was 50, I didn't say I wanted to be a divorce coach. So when I was a kid, you know how you take those aptitude tests and they kind of narrow down and say, this is what you can be. Mine was kind of like, you can do whatever you want, which didn't help much.
Yeah, you went a little direction at that point.
So I floated around in what I wanted to be. A designer, an architect, an engineer. Mm-hmm. I applied for college as an engineering student, and then I switched real fast because I only applied because, and we're kind of coming full circle now because it's very popular again, but in the 80s, and I will date myself, when I went to college, like being an engineer was do that. You're going to have a job forever. It's really secure. And when I thought about it after I graduated and before I went to college, I was like, I'm not an engineer. I might be good in math and science, but that is not my jam. So I got my degree in advertising.
Okay. So we're similar degrees. I went to college about the same time, got a degree in public relations journalism. And my dad was a mechanical engineer, and he would look at me and say, what the hell are you going to do?
What do you do? Yeah, my dad was a draftsman.
Yeah, well, very, mm-hmm. very similar.
Yes.
Yeah,
and my older sister is an engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I deviated.
So where'd you go to school?
Michigan State.
A Spartan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go for advertising. I know you kind of worked your way through college, too. Talk about some of those early jobs you had.
Oh, geez. Food service jobs. Like my first job was, this is back to the cheerleading, seems to be a thing I haven't talked about in decades, and here it is. jobs were really hard to find when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I put in 50 applications to get just, you know, a minimum wage starting job.
A high school job.
Could not find a job to save my life. I finally got hired at Burger King. Mm-hmm. The reason I got hired was because the gentleman who was managing that store had been laid off from his job. So he was doing this interim until he got called back, and he was really angry about it because he did not want to be managing a Burger King, but he was in charge of hiring. So he only hired cheerleaders. So the only reason I got the job was because I was a cheerleader. And it was funny because, you know, you see all the other cheerleaders throughout the towns where you'd play games, and then you'd see them at work again because there they were. So that job, I was on the late night shift. So I would work from usually 11 at night until 4 or 5 in the morning. And we would close down the drive-through and then clean. You know, cleaning mm-hmm. the fry baskets, cleaning the shake machine. It was not a glamorous shop.
What did it teach you, though?
I don't have a great answer for that because I think I just expected to work hard to get paid.
Yeah, you were raised.
Yeah, it was a good balance. I went in, I did my job. I tried to do my job as well as I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what it taught me is, while there were aspirational jobs, like in that little first job of mine, the aspiration was to work the drive-thru. The drive-thru was the cool job out of all the Burger King jobs. But I didn't mind cleaning the fryer, and I had to clean the fryer in order to be trusted and prove myself that I could work the drive-thru and be trusted with money,
right?
You know, in that way. So it was just kind of a natural evolution of you do what you're told to do. You do it as well as you can. You will get a paycheck. You will keep your job. And if you work really hard, you'll probably move up, even if moving up is just to the drive-thru.
And food services is a great example of that, because I worked in food services through high school and college, and it's very hierarchical. It's very team-oriented, and everyone does have to make sacrifices and do things that they don't necessarily want to do.
Yeah, although I would say I would have more favorite things to do.
Yeah.
But I did really look at, like, in college, I worked in the cafeteria. That was my first job in college.
That was the largest
cafeteria
in the world?
World's largest non-military, cafeteria. It was enormous. It was a huge cafeteria. And, you know, there were great shifts there where you just... We had to click cards when people came in, you know, click their meal card. That was, you got to see everyone. You got to chat. It was really easy. You wore normal clothes. Or there was the pots and pans job.
Yeah, that's tough.
Which was hard and filthy, and it was hot, and it was like, there was nothing lovely about that, but you pulled your shift and you did your job.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't my favorite,
but it got
it was
through
part
school.
Of the package. Yeah. And then I went on and I did a lot of more. Food service got me through college.
Yeah.
I was a TA my first year, and that was kind of fun, and it was aspirational because I was the only freshman by year.
I was going to say, a freshman TA is unusual.
Mm-hmm. I went in with some credits, and I was in the Honors College, and I had a lot going for me as far as getting noticed.
Mm-hmm.
So when I asked for it, they kind of looked at my credentials and looked over my age. So that was, I guess the lesson there is ask.
Yeah.
They could say no. They didn't in that case. But, you know, plenty of times people have said no to me since then. And, of course, prior to then. But that part was good. But that was more for the career building, resume building, learning.
But you went in as a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
And really, freshmen aren't teaching assistants at that point.
Mm-mm.
And said to yourself, I've got the credentials. Can't hurt to ask, can it?
Right. Yeah. And I took the course. We were trimesters at the time. So I took the course first trimester and then asked for the job second. And by the third trimester, I was a TA for it. And that also helped me get through school.
Yeah.
You know, because that's a paid position. Yeah. And I worked in the cafeteria. I worked in restaurants. And I kept moving up in restaurants. You know, I started at the Burger King. And then I was at the Big Boy. And then I was at a steakhouse. So I guess everything notches up.
Do you have a love of cooking today because you worked in the restaurant business?
I have always had a love of cooking. Yeah. That was my therapy. When I was a kid, I would cook. My mom was a very good sport because I would get a bee in my bonnet too. I want to make a Black Forest cake. And she would take me to the store and get all the ingredients to make the Black Forest cake. And I would cook away, or, you know, one weekend it would be like, I'm going to try bread.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to make tortillas. And my dad would make me a tortilla press and I would make tortillas.
Oh, those are good parents.
Yeah. Yeah. They were very encouraging as far as making of things.
Yeah. What's your favorite thing to make now?
Ooh, I don't know if I have a favorite. I don't often repeat recipes.
Yeah. Do you follow recipes?
I improvise a lot. Yeah.
So you're a cook then?
Yeah, I'm a cook. I'm not a baker.
Right.
My daughter is
an
exceptional baker. It was much too measurement oriented for me.
Yeah, you need a little this and a little that.
Yeah, and I'll just like start with ingredients and then make food. Or my daughter is now a chef in New York, and she's cooking actually tonight. She's cooking a private dinner. And over the weekend, we talked several times, and we're both looking up recipes and sending them back and forth. And here's a picture of this for her to plan her dinner tonight. But I don't have a favorite thing because I just make a new thing almost every time I make a thing.
I know
often
exactly
repeat.
What you're saying.
Yeah.
I like to cook. I'm the same way. I really don't follow recipes. I use them for ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned something of shooting recipes back. One of my great joys right now is both my daughters have inherited a love of cooking. So I'll get a picture of their meal that mm-hmm. they made on Friday night.
You know, yeah,
look, Dad, it's great. I made this, this, and this, and it's okay. Or give me your Italian spinach recipe.
Yeah.
All of those things are very heartening. And we'll be back on cooking talk here in a minute.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I keep deviating.
No, I'm the one
Let's
deviating.
Talk brain health. Let's talk cooking.
So you're working all that through college. You're studying advertising. What do you do when you get out?
Moved to Chicago.
Good town to move to.
It was a good town to move to. The two big cities in the country at the time mm-hmm. for advertising, it's going to be New York and Chicago.
All the big firms were there.
All the big firms at the time. Now it's more spread out. Even when I was in it in the 80s and 90s, it became much more spread out geographically, yeah. let's say. But I did not have enough money to go anywhere else. And I had $500 when I graduated from college and some furniture in my studio apartment and a big fat old farm cat named Remington. And a couple of my friends helped me load up a U-Haul and moved to a studio apartment in Chicago.
Did you have a job when you got there, or did you go looking
not.
For one?
I did not. I went looking for one.
Wow, so you went blindly.
I had a food service job lined up. I had a job lined up in a restaurant because
that's what you've been doing. Yeah. You knew.
And I also knew that I could make ends meet working in a restaurant. You just try and you fall into things. And I would say I've done that a lot in my life. So I moved to Chicago. I had my studio apartment. I just needed a job. I had the restaurant job. So I was doing that, but you know, I'm a brand new college graduate. Yeah. I didn't want to be slinging chicken. So I was like gung ho to get any job I could get. So I interviewed for a job as a receptionist. And you know, this is kind of the cheerleader story again. The woman who interviewed me, her name was Gail, and I have a sister named Gail. It's making me teary. And she hired me because we hit it off and had a personal connection. There were a slew of graduates mm-hmm. going to Chicago in advertising, looking for jobs just like me, who probably had better resumes, but we had a personal connection. And she was like, I'm going to give you a shot.
And those are important.
Oh, yeah. And I was not too proud to go, I'm not going to be a receptionist. I was like, I'll get in there any way I can, and then I will work hard and I will prove myself. And I was a receptionist for 3 months. And then I was a secretary for about 5 months. And then I was an assistant account executive. And within 2 years, I was an account director.
Was this one of the big ad agencies?
It was Hal Reiney and Partners.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They did the Honda ads, didn't they?
They did they got Saturn,
That's
which in the time
was
a big
ads.
Deal.
Yep.
They did Bartleby and James.
Yep.
They did.
God, Bartle and James. God, those were
Bartle
great.
Bartle and James, yeah.
Yeah, those were great ads.
Yeah, they did so many great creative ads, and they were one of the really hot creative shops. They were a spinoff of Oglesby and Mather.
Yeah.
And Hal bought them and then started. He was in San Francisco.
They were the hottest
Chicago.
Name in the 80s. And
oh, 90s. They were. Yeah. And I just landed there because I said, okay, I'll be a receptionist.
Well, and I think that's an important point you bring out. And particularly in the 80s and 90s, that was the way in the door for mm-hmm. so many people into advertising. They had their advertising degree. They really shouldn't be a receptionist. They really shouldn't be a secretary. They really shouldn't be a junior, whatever. But that was the only way in. And to your point, you work that job as hard as you can. And it leads to good things.
Yep. And it was fun.
Yeah. Those were heydays.
Hard work.
Yeah.
Yeah. It still had a bit of the Mad Men thing mm-hmm. about it. I think that by the 90s was wearing thin.
Yeah.
And I had, nieces and nephews who worked in, not in the business, not exactly the same vein as I did, but later, 2010s, and it was not the same business. It was way more fun before.
Yeah, I always say I was probably born 10, 15 years too late to really enjoy the broadcast industry the way it used to be. And advertising was very much the same way because the two integrated so well together.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about your career progression, receptionist, secretary, junior account executive.
I just worked my way up and I cared deeply about my job. I cared a lot about doing a really good job. Clients could see that. when clients like you, the people at the agency are really happy because the clients pay us and you move up.
Yeah.
So I continued to move up. By the time I was 28, I was then at a different agency and I was a vice president, managing director. And I
That's a young age for that.
It was a young age for that.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember how many people I managed. I don't know, around 18 or 20.
Wow.
I had a $70 million account, which now doesn't sound like that much, but in the
1980s,
it was a lot of money. And it was fun. And I had a love-hate relationship with it by then. I think I was looking for a different sort of fulfillment. Mm-hmm. You know, I was successful on the exterior. I had a good title. I made a lot of money for my age and the time. And kept thinking, well, maybe there's something different I should be doing.
Well, it probably dominated your life too.
You know, definitely dominated my life.
It wasn't just 8 to 5.
Oh, no. And one of my clients for the longest time at the end of that part of my career was a retailer, and they were at their desk at 6, and they were, you know, they were racing themselves, the executives, like they, we called them the 8th floor people, but the senior executives who ran this company would race in to see who got to their desk first. And they would think nothing of calling me, and I better be at my desk. So I would go in at 6. And, you know, if we were finishing a commercial and it had to ship, we'd be in an editing studio until 11, 12, 1 in the morning, dependent on the day, but you never left before 7 or 8 at night. So they were long hours.
Even if you were in that studio till 11 or midnight, you were still expected to be at your desk at 7. It wasn't, I worked till midnight, so I'm coming in 4 hours later.
No. They took no free pass. You took no free pass. You were there. And it fed on itself, right? Because when my client would call and I would pick up the phone, there was a certain inherent or earned respect from him because, oh, you see that I'm working hard and you're there for me and you're working hard for me.
Send a message.
Exactly. And if I was not returning that call until 9 a.m., I mean, things might be different now. I don't know. But I certainly wouldn't have earned that account and moved up as I moved up.
And I think that's one of the big cultural changes over the last decade and a half is that I think our generation came up with that I better be there. Because we didn't have the ways to stay connected. Cell phones weren't big at that time. Mm-hmm. The internet wasn't there at that time. So you had to be at your desk because if that phone rang, by God, I'm not going to miss that call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the, you know, looking back, was it very balanced? Probably not. But I was in my 20s and I had no kids. And it was a different space of life. Yeah. And maybe we were raised more in that. Remember, to get that first job, I had to put in 50 applications. So, you know, God, I'm going to keep this job and I'm going to, they weren't easy to come by.
No, not at all. So how long did you do that and what did you do next?
I did that until my early 30s. And then I decided to make a career change and I left to go back to school to become a teacher, to get my master's in teaching.
That's a big change.
It was a big change. And, you know, you asked what I wanted to be in high school. One of the things on my list was to be a teacher.
Yeah.
And I sadly was told by counselors, oh, no, don't do that. That's for people who can't do anything else. They were so misguided and wrong.
Counselors?
This was from teaching. Yeah, from teachers. But it was like, no, you belong out in the business world, go have a career. You can always fall back on that if you want to. I mean, it was like, treat that like a hobby. but I really felt called to teaching.
Yeah.
And this, if we get to the end of where I am now, it's a windy path and it kind of all fits together. So I went back to get my master's in teaching and I had been in an advertising agency where I had a client who really liked me. We had a great relationship. And he then hired me to consult. So I was doing this dual thing of I built my own marketing firm and it was much more than less consumer and more business to business.
Mm-hmm.
I had one main client and several smaller clients and I was working on my master's degree. And then I started having children.
Yeah.
So I did all of those concurrently And it worked out really well. I had great support from, we had an au pair. Before that, my boys were in daycare. And then when I had my third, we had an au pair. So I was really able to balance the schoolwork and the self-employment entrepreneurial part of it. And I had a great client relationship. And we just loved working with each other. And that was fabulous. And a lot of flexibility, which also meant I could be up at 2 a.m. That is also flexibility, finishing a project or, you know, writing a presentation or whatever, but I could fit it all in.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for many years, and it took me about 5 years to finish my teaching degree, during which time I had 3 children and I was still doing my marketing. So then my main client, he retired. It was time for him to retire. And the company said, we would love to have you keep doing what you're doing, but you have to come work here full time.
Oh,
you know, looking back, I hadn't worked full time in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, worked for an employer. I had worked for myself. I worked sometimes more than full time, but
you had your own pattern.
You
were able to do everything. But it was a different time where it was either do this or
do this. And my kids were little, and I saw at this company, I saw how the full-time folks worked, and I knew I'd have to leave my house at 7 and I'd get home at 7 and I would not be seeing them, and there was no working from home, and it would be 5 days a week, and that wasn't enticing to me. So I left working outside of the home, and I was really lucky to, I mean, best time of my life, raising my kids.
Yeah.
I got to play with 3 little kids and be and imagine and cook.
Yeah.
I have pictures of my oldest when he was like 2 making his scrambled eggs at the stove and stuff. And it was just delightful. So I kind of eased out of corporate world. I had my master's. I never taught in a school because then it didn't make sense to me to pay someone to raise my kids while I went and taught other people's kids. So I taught gifted programs that were shorter duration and on weekends, and I wrote curriculum. And I spent a lot of years volunteering in my community and driving kids to soccer and being a Girl Scout leader and
living life.
Yeah.
This sounds like a strange question, but I'll ask it anyway. What drives you? And I'm asking that from the standpoint of you embark on a great advertising career, but something says, I want something different. What is that that's driving you to quote? Because so many people can get into that. You know what? I like the paycheck. I like the title. I like this. But you have something driving you that said, I'm enjoying this, but it's not quite what I want.
Oh, yeah. And don't get me wrong. There were times I really didn't enjoy it. And I was really tired, or it was really frustrating. I mean, Nothing's perfect. Nothing is all roses and unicorns.
Nope.
But I think my definition of success over the years has shifted. You know, you ask my 18-year-old self what the definition of success is, getting into a good college, being able to pay my way through, getting good grades. You ask my 22-year-old self, moving up the food chain, making a name for myself, making a lot of money, having people, you know, tell me I'm doing a good job, a lot of outward.
That affirmation's important.
You know, into my early 30s, it was more like, am I really making a difference? Yeah, I can sell people stuff advertising-wise. Am I enjoying it anymore? Do I need? And now, I was also in a really fortunate situation. I was married at the time, and my spouse made a lot of money. And he loved his job. His life was about his job. And that allowed me to have my life not be about my job.
That's
but
good.
To be about my kids. It was good for some things. It was not necessarily good for a marriage, right? Because our lives were about different things.
Yeah.
So in my 30s, it started like switching to education, I think, was more of a, I have the privilege and option of doing something that I feel is more of a give back that I'm really interested in doing. I found teaching fascinating. My degree was in special education, what it was called at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So learning disabilities and behavior disorders. And I kind of looked at that crew, especially the kids who were labeled with behavior disorders, as a forgotten bunch who tended to be shoved in a room, and that called to me. And like I said, so I got the degree and did a lot of student teaching and did volunteering in schools. I think the skill set I learned applies to many, many, many other areas, mm-hmm. not just kids who are receiving differentiated services in schools. And then, you know, in my 30s, I had my kids, and into my 40s. And the most important thing was being there as they went through their things.
Yeah.
You know, for a long time.
That's really important.
It was. And I do not ever underestimate what a privilege that was to have that ability to spend time with them. And I still had the opportunity to, you know, I had friends, I had activities, I volunteered, I played paddle, which is not a thing down in Chattanooga, but it was really fun.
Played what? Paddle?
It's platform tennis.
Okay.
Which, it's this weird sport. It's usually only in the north because it's more of a cold weather. It's outside in a small court, like a pickleball court, with a chicken wire cage. So you're inside walls. And you play kind of like tennis doubles, but with a paddle, not a racket, and you can play it off the wall. It's just, yeah. It's a way to make really long Chicago winters bearable.
The chicken wire got me.
Yeah, it bounces. The ball bounces off the wires.
So you've gone through all this. You're doing the teaching. You're raising your kids.
Raising my kids. My kids are getting a little older. Yeah. They're more self-sufficient. And I went, what now?
Yeah.
And then I became a yoga teacher. So I loved yoga. Yoga from the time my first child was born was the thing I always kept returning to. Mm-hmm. It would just call me back. I felt it was very healing. I mean, not just the physical part of it, but the entire practice of it. So I became a yoga instructor and then was building a practice teaching. And then life took a turn.
Well, let's talk about the turn because it gets us to what you're doing today.
It does indeed. So I had just started maybe a year and a half into yoga, and my husband, then husband, lost his job. And when he lost his job, he took a break. And that break looked like pretty much becoming isolated and watching a lot of TV, you know, Seinfeld and Blackhawks games, and sitting in a recliner. And his mindset was just he was taking a break. Mm-hmm. When he lost his job, I looked around and went, well, yoga does not have benefits. Yoga will not send kids to college. Like, it truly was a very good, fun, now we would call it side hustle, I guess. Mm-hmm. And this might not have been correct. Had I buckled down and really tried to make a go of yoga, maybe it would have been different. But I just thought, this isn't the thing I should be doing as a responsible parent right now. He's taking a break. I need to get a job. So I became a financial advisor.
I get that, where you're coming from. You feel responsible.
And I had, as I said, like, I had a lot of privilege.
Yeah. You felt, in a great sense, it was your time or turn to step in and carry the majority of the weight.
Yes. And do something. And I looked at marketing and advertising, and honestly, I felt like I had aged out in many ways. I didn't have contacts anymore. I didn't relish the thought of going back and working for, and this, how's this for a turn of events? Because I would have been like the people who worked for me when I was in my 20s. So it would have been me going back and working for someone in their 20s and me in an underling position. And that just was not attractive to me. And I kind of felt like it's changed a lot. And it wasn't been there, done that. And that's not moving forward. So became a financial advisor. And that was just a lot of studying and certifications. My financial advisor for a decade had been telling me, you should do this, because she would come in for our review meetings and I've had all my spreadsheets done, and I was really into it, and I did the family finances. So not having any idea what I was getting into, I said, okay, I'll do this. And then I did that, and that was perhaps like Often jumping into the unknown serves me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that time it really did. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know, not about the finances, I got that, but about where I was employed. And it really, I kind of had come from this, you know your stuff, you work hard, you do the job, all things work out.
Right.
And it was more of a, it was more of a sales position than a serving position. Although you often hear people in the industry tout, no, we're here to serve. But my experience in the beginning years was it was a sales job. And it was really hard. I was not good at it. I struggled. You know, you're supposed to learn how to pivot and how to find the pain points. And it felt incongruous, unaligned. And I was trying to figure out how to make that work. I was away from my kids,
yeah,
which was, I still had flexibility to go to their games and stuff like that to a degree, much more than if I was working a 9-to-5, which in Chicago would have been a 7-to-7 job. But it was not necessarily a happy career choice for me, which kind of surprised me. And it was really unnatural for me. I was not good at it.
Well, going back to your husband losing his job, you're identifying a position as a financial advisor that, okay, this can support the family. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily turn out to be what you thought it would be.
No, it was all commission, 100% yeah, commission.
That's,
and
that's
you know, and they use phrases like, you know, you eat what you kill. Like,
well, yep.
Yuck. yeah. Like, I'm a vegetarian. I don't kill things.
Well, and from your point of it being more of a sales job, you've got to come in and build a list. You're contacting relatives, you're contacting
it's
friends, you're contacting people you've done. Yeah. Hey, let me tell you what I'm doing now.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so, and there are other ways I've learned since then, but at that time I didn't know. And it was all the things that baby financial advisors, I happen to be a baby financial advisor in my late 40s, but it was all the things that they hear about. This is how you do it. You know, shotgun, we don't know what's going to stick. You got to try everything. It was very uncomfortable for me. But that being said, at the same time, about a year and a half into that, my husband came home and said he wanted a divorce.
Now, might be too personal a question. Was that just out of the blue? Did you have any inkling?
I did not.
Okay.
I did
not. So how's that hit you?
that knocked me for a loop.
Couldn't imagine.
And I didn't handle it well. So I have since learned that usually when one spouse wants a divorce, the statistic is they have been thinking about it for 2 years on average. Sometimes more, sometimes less, but about 2 years. I didn't know that at the time. I should have, in retrospect. But now,
how would you though?
I don't know. Things become clearer when you look back and go, I see that now.
Yeah, you can see it now, but when you're in the middle of it, it's all just...
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, he just said he was done. Therapy didn't work. There's no glue. I'm out. And then he told me to leave and go to paddle practice. and I was in shock and I left. And we started down this terrible, terrible divorce path. And the people I work with, I encourage them. Like, they don't even have to like each other. And they might be very angry at each other, rageful, hurt. But you can still communicate.
Yeah.
And that just dropped.
But you need to.
Yeah. Ideally. And we didn't. And it was a year and a half and a six-figure divorce and very stereotypically soap opera bad.
Yeah. But kind of like, well, I don't even want to say, The War of the Roses, you know, that old movie.
Yeah, not as bad as Peeing on the Fish, but it's pretty close. I don't know that other people would have seen the movie, but yeah, there was a scene where someone peed on the fish anyway.
But you've taken a job as a financial analyst that you don't necessarily love. It's not what you turned out to be. And then your world gets rocked even more with that. So how do you cope with that?
Poorly. Like I said, I was completely stressed out. I drank way too much. I wanted to hide. And at the same time, my stress was like over the top. As you said, you know, it's all about the work part of it. You need to find prospects, you need to find leads, you need to hone your sales skills, yada, yada. I'd be up at 2 a.m. trying to make call lists for corporations to talk to them about in-service withdrawals. Like, it was horrific. I was not
present. I was not supported. And I was in a process that I didn't understand. I didn't know. Like, the inclination is to say, know your rights. But I didn't know what was right.
Yeah.
And that was different. And I didn't have space or support to figure out my next best step. So I think I made a lot of faux pas. And at the same time, I was kind of like, okay, fine. I'll show you. I'll do this myself.
Yeah.
I got this. And my ex, the day he told me that he wanted a divorce, he was still unemployed. I found out later that he actually had a job offer, and his perception seemed to be that he was going to move on with his life and his new job, and good luck to me. It's been nice. Or maybe it hasn't. I don't know, but I'm gone. He thought it would be easy peasy. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And that's that, clean.
Yep.
And when it came to things like dividing assets, he was horrified and I was proud. And it just was, it was not, the whole thing was not well managed. And it didn't have, I think the biggest thing in retrospect, there was no one, there was no professional saying, okay, here's the reality check. This is what would happen if you go to court, because here are the laws in our jurisdiction. So why don't you two just play nice and figure out, given this framework, what is best for your family and your futures? And that's how I try to frame things with my clients. And rather, we had folks who, and I liked them as people, but as professionals, they would really not give a lot of guidance. They would bill a lot of hours. They would kind of sit there and go, well, you guys work it out. It's like, where's the framework?
Yeah.
You know, and you're not supposed to, because if you're working it out of court, in their mind, you weren't supposed to use what would happen in court as a backdrop, but in actuality it is, because that's the recourse.
So at what point did you take the lemons and make lemonade? When did the light bulb go off that you said, wait a second here, I've been through this, mm-hmm. and this is screwed up, and I got a better yeah. way of doing this?
When we were done, there were immediately mistakes were evident. So that was the first thing that was like, you got to be kidding me. These could have been foreseen. So that's when I did the certified divorce financial analyst degree certification. So I did that education course. And that
was that through your financial planning or financial advisor job? Or how did you find out about that?
I did it independently. Because the mistakes that were, the actual mistakes that were made were financial mistakes in mm-hmm. our decree, which landed us 4 years later back in court. And I was a financial advisor and yeah. I didn't know them. What happens to people who don't know finances?
Right.
So I found the certification through the process of learning more about divorce. And then because I was already a financial advisor, you know, that was easy to step into. It's mostly financial advisors who become CDFAs. Some attorneys can become CDFAs. Those are usually the two careers. CPAs, I guess, can as well. We all bring our own mm-hmm. specialties to it. But my thought process was, this is awful. This is a horrible thing. And I don't want anyone to ever go through this in the same way. And it's preventable. So how can I help? Mm-hmm. Like, how can I take where I am and what I know and put it to use to help other people not have this happen? Became a CDFA, started working with people in that vein, and two things happened. One was the financial services company that I was affiliated with. They just like it when you sell stuff. They did not like me doing this work. And from a compliance point of view, made it really, really difficult. And financial advisors out there listening to this will go, oh, compliance, I understand. But it was like, yeah, that's cute. You can put that certification on your business card, but don't you even go try to do that. And what have you sold this week?
Yeah.
So that was not a good fit. So I parted ways with them and went to another firm with the understanding that I could build this into and make this mostly my practice. And then I was working with people doing the CDFA work. And the missing link to me was the emotional component. And there are those out there who will tell people going through a divorce, you just need to think logically.
Just put your head down and get through it.
That's garbage.
Yeah.
Because divorce is again, research, but reality, divorce is the second most emotional thing people can go through. Death of a spouse, divorce is second, which in a way is death of a spouse because your whole marriage is, and your life is leaving.
And I would imagine losing a job is up there too. And you had experienced that on your husband's side. So you're getting kind of the whammy there.
It was a lot. It's been a lot. But sometimes it's a lot, you know, sometimes that's how life works. So as I was looking at this and trying to help people through and, you know, not use mumbo jumbo and not use acronyms and help them understand what their financial position was and what the ramifications of their decisions were, the missing component was that emotional part and tying that in with the logical decisions. So I became a divorce coach, which was another certification. And that's really about helping people understand the process, manage the process, be empowered, have a thinking partner, have someone who is knowledgeable bounce their decisions off of and figure out what they want to do, because they're often making really life-changing decisions as they're going through divorce, and they might not have the correct support system for that. And the divorce coaching certification, that really teaches, that's what it's all about, kind of walking the path with them to figure out what's best for them. And then after that was done, I became a mediator, and that kind of wraps it all together, and a collaboratively trained professional. So collaborative process is something we're trying to bring to Chattanooga. We just finished our first case, and it's a different sort of training. It's called alternative dispute resolution. It was born of an attorney up in Minnesota in the 90s who did family law, who again said, there's got to be a better way. And with trained attorneys involved, has a process where rather than, you know, facing off in a court system where your adversaries, it takes it out of the court system. It's still within the parameters of the legal system. So people know the boundaries of what would happen in court, but the decisions are based on goals, not winning.
And that's still all just divorce centered.
All divorce centered. I mean, you can apply the theories to other things, but in my case, it's all divorce.
Do you work with either the husband or the wife, mm-hmm. or do you focus exclusively on the wife?
I tend to work most with couples.
Okay.
So with couples, and interestingly, it's about 50-50 whether the husband or wife find me.
Mm-hmm.
But there are couples who don't want to go through the court system and they need guidance as to what decisions they need to make, what mistakes they need to avoid, basically getting the information that they need to shape their own divorce. So it's not a DIY. It's not a, you know, 395 bargain basement process. It really is spending the time to put together a quality parenting plan that goes way deeper than who the kids are spending what day with and who drives them there at what time. So it's more about how are you going to co-parent together and how are you going to make these decisions when the kids are four that will still work when they're 10.
So you're not working with one or the other as in team husband or team wife. You're working with them both to get through this horrible heart-wrenching process.
I do work with individuals as a coach and as a financial to when they're going through litigation, I'm an advocate, I'm on their side, and I will help them figure out their stuff. But that's not the majority of what I do. And while it can be more interesting because that can be more challenging. You know, you're trying to solve a puzzle. I loved algebra as a kid. And it was when you're doing those things, you're, you know, solving for, you're finding things when it's in litigation. So yeah, that can be fun, but I still think it's more damaging. And I do informed mediation. It's working with a couple. It's different than most mediators in this area in that we're sitting at the same table. They're having face-to-face discussions, even when they're hard, and they're deciding themselves, but with good information, what they want to do for their family. A judge isn't deciding. They're not having someone travel between rooms saying, let's make a deal. You know, here's the offer. What's your counteroffer? And we look at both of their expenses and their budgets as they live independently. And we look at what they need and we look at how far their money will go. And we look at how they want to raise their kids and what's important to them. And I've had people work with me and make decisions like, they're going to forego alimony, which they had a right to, in order to keep their kids in private school. And it's a family decision. Mm-hmm. A judge would not likely have decided something like that. If that was in front of a judge, the kid's school would have been, pull them out. It would, you know, put them in the public school. I don't care what it is. And you have to pay alimony. Because rightfully, that's what each lawyer would have fought for. And I find that when people see, even if it's someone they can barely speak to anymore, when they see that a possible financial solution could leave them with an untenable standard of living, like basically leave them in poverty, then they stop thinking about winning and they start looking at them like a human who they loved once and don't want to be in a horrible financial situation. And the financial decisions shift based on that because it's in context instead of, oh, I need 52%. Why? It's more.
Yeah.
And who is served by that?
Yeah, but I won.
But I won.
Yeah.
And no one wins.
Yeah. I've got a few more questions for you because we're running out of time. There's a couple things I want to ask you. The title of the book.
Yeah.
Talk about the title of the book, where you came up with it. I can imagine how you
came up with it. I did not come up with it.
No?
No. My title was How to Divorce with Dignity and Grace. And as we went through this, we tested how to divorce with dignity and grace. And dignity and grace did not call to people when they were faced with, you know, I'm getting divorced. Yeah.
They identify with the other title, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the title came from the people who responded to a selection of titles or what they would name it or whatever. And it wasn't How to Divorce with Dignity and Grace. It was, oh shit, I'm getting divorced. And almost every single phone call I get, and I get a lot of phone calls, the first thing is, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know where to start.
Well, and I'd imagine a lot of people get blindsided.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even the ones who want it.
Yeah.
My husband wanted it, but he wasn't educated about divorce when he said he wanted a divorce.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of education, necessary. So unfortunately, there are a lot of, like if you see on social media, someone will post, I'm getting divorced and, you know, 50 people will comment, you know, you need this attorney. They're a bulldog. You need, this is what you need to do. No, you need a DIY. It should only cost you $200. Well, they don't know you other than you post it on Facebook. How do they know what you need? Don't take advice from social media for your life.
Yeah, exactly.
And even if they got divorced, you know, last month, their situation is not the same as yours.
And every situation is different.
Yeah.
Absolutely. How can people get in touch with you?
My website is bridgingdivorcesolutions.com. That's a good place to start.
Good place to start.
Yeah, you can set up an appointment there. The phone number is 844-306-0166, and that's also on the website. And the book is on Amazon. And important note that I did not even consider before, people will say, I want to read your book. I want to get your book, but I don't want to order it on my Amazon account. Because they want the information, they want to read it, but they don't want their spouse to see it. I had a friend, when the book launched, she bought it in support, and her husband came home and said, do we need to talk? She was like, no, it's Brenda's book.
You should have an alternative title of, I'm happier than I've ever been in my life.
Or, you know, how to make a kale smoothie. That's a safe one. So they can also call the office and order an electronic book, or we have hard copies in the office if they don't want to procure it on Amazon.
That's a great point. I never thought of.
I didn't either.
Yeah.
I didn't until people started telling me that. It's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Should have thought of that.
Well, before I get to the last question, I need to thank our sponsor, Tennessee Valley Authority, for sponsoring My Morning Cup. You can follow TVA on social media to learn more about its multifaceted mission of service and visit tva.com/do-good-here to explore exciting TVA career opportunities. I've enjoyed our conversation,
me
Brenda.
Too.
You started out earlier in the podcast talking about your 18-year-old self, 22-year-old self. I'm going to take you back to your 25-year-old self.
Okay.
What would you tell your 25-year-old self is important for a happy life?
My gut says, keep thinking about what you're doing. Don't autopilot it. You change. Think about what's important to you. Think about what your goals are. Think about what's meaningful. And don't be afraid to pivot because situations change. We grow. We change. Important things change.
And what I hear you say there is you're not pigeonholed. Don't be afraid mm-hmm. to do something different.
Don't be stuck. Don't be stuck. Be adaptable.
Well, I think if anyone's proven that, you have. You definitely took lemons and made lemonade out of them, and you're helping people.
That's my goal. That's my mission.
Well, I've enjoyed talking to you. I really appreciate you coming in.
I appreciate you having me. It was fun.
Thanks for listening to My Morning Cup, a podcast by Consta Media Advisors. If you liked this episode, please share it with a friend. I release a new episode each week, so be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts.